In this episode, I am joined by those masters of creation, Doug and Matt, as they educate me on creating cults and orders for a campaign. Welcome to the Mithras Matters Podcast, Season 1, Episode 47, Creating Cults, Including Those Restrictions. And welcome to Mithras Matters, a podcast dedicated to the Mithras rule set and all its supplements. As always, I am your host, Inwills, and welcome to July. So, to be perfectly honest with you, I am not going to add too much to this episode since we have an excellent segment about creating cults for your campaigns. Just to say that, remember, if you would like to contribute to the podcast, then why not drop me an email or message and let me know what you would like to cover. I'm always looking for reviews or chats with people, so if you are interested, you can email me at inwills@gmail.com or send me a message on the various forums I frequent. Okay, without further ado, let's get straight into it with Matt and Doug introducing themselves.
Hi, I'm Matt Eager of Old Bones Publishing. I write scenarios and game aids, mostly for Mithras, but I'm branching out a little bit to other game systems now, just testing the waters.
Ooh.
So I'm a frequent flyer on the Mithras Discord, and I'm a frequent guest on the podcast. Thanks, Inwills.
Yeah, and you are also the rules guru as well.
Yes.
And Doug, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Doug Nordwall, also known as Raleel on many places online, including the Mithras Discord. I'm the admin on there. I'm on many, many forums. I have a blog, d100-workshop.blogspot.com, where you can find all sorts of interesting stuff about Mithras. I've been doing Mithras for, a decade or so at this point, and run many, many games.
Fantastic. And we had a wonderful chat in a previous episode about setting up campaigns and where to start. And I thought it would be really interesting to follow up that talk and for you to almost like educate me and tell me how things are, how you create new content or campaigns. And I really want to focus on something that gave me a bit of issue in the beginning, this idea of cults or brotherhoods. And where did these originate from, Doug?
Sure.
Yeah.
So we should, first off, we should start and talk about the word cult, because at least in American minds, this has a particular connotation behind it, that it's some sort of person who's has a deviant religious background or something like that. And that's not really what it is. This is the sociological term for cult. And you can really just think about it as a group with a belief structure. And that belief structure can be a whole bunch of different things. It can be just about any organization, arguably just about any company that's got a mission statement and you believe in that mission statement, that makes it a cult. It's in Mithras terms. Brotherhoods in the book are really just distinguish it because of the fact that they don't have magic. And both of these together kind of represent a holdover from RuneQuest, because that's where that came from.
I was going to say, I think technically brotherhoods can have magic, but what I was going to say is brotherhoods aren't hooked into a religious belief system. It's usually more of a practical, daily living kind of system.
Yeah. Yeah, in any event, it really doesn't matter. The terminology is sort of setting specific, right? Like it's, you know, they had cults to this and that god in RuneQuest, and brotherhoods were something else entirely. Right. But in Mithras, it's really kind of the same stew. You don't have to be held to that at
right,
all.
Exactly. Back in, I think the word cult has been part of the D100 lexicon since the very beginning, almost in RuneQuest. And one of the earliest supplements was Cults of Prax, for example, right there in the
yeah table. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I've actually got that. I actually have that supplement.
Very oh, yeah. I mean, like I had a character back in RuneQuest in the early 90s, and they were going to join a cult as well. I mean, it's really just a term that's been held on to for a long time, and it doesn't, you don't have to think about it like that. And I think a lot of people get hung up on, it's like, oh, I don't want to join a cult, I don't want to join a religious thing, right? And it's not like that. It's just an organization. Yeah. It can be a school, it can be a temple, it can be a whole bunch of different stuff. It can be literally just a teacher and a student, yeah. Right?
Back in the day, I think that was one of the key things that separated RuneQuest from D&D, because it was kind of dyadic back then in like 1978.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they didn't hand out experience points in RuneQuest, but one of the key pieces of character progression was becoming a more important and powerful member of your community, which was sort of all right. woven together with your cult standing.
Right.
So this is really, this right. is really in the D100 DNA from the beginning.
Exactly.
And I think this is, if people are coming from 5e or like a level based system, then this is something that I think, if I'm right, is quite important, these cults and brotherhood, especially for spellcasters like Theist. Is that right? Because don't they have levels that you need to progress up on?
Yeah, I mean, they have ranks, right? Like these represent, you know, gateways where you have to show that you have reached a certain level of responsibility or power within the cult to gain access to stuff. So, I mean, like the most obvious example is you know, if you took a sorcery school, they're not going to give you a big damaging spell to a young caster because they can't trust them. Right. Like as simple as that. Right. Like they can't trust them to do that. Just like if you are going to be an electrician, they don't give you full access to everything out of the gate. Right. Like they don't let you operate on your own as an engineer. You have to reach a certain level to do that. If you're a scientist, you know, you operate in a laboratory under supervision of somebody else. And they don't let you just go off and write a paper on your own to do this stuff, right? Like you have to go through all the process to learn the science, to learn the foundations of it before they allow you to go forward.
Right. Well said. I'm thinking of Mickey Mouse and the Sorcerer's Apprentice, you know? That's what we want to
exactly. avoid. Exactly. That's a fantastic example of why you don't give them that, right? Like you don't want it to be the Sorcerer's right. Apprentice in your game, right? That gets a little insane.
Really, so it seems to me that it's almost like an essential part of a campaign. Is it something that we need to think about early on in the campaign, or is it something that we can develop as the campaign grows?
Both. You can run a campaign without cults and brotherhoods, especially if you're more into like, you know, one-shot adventures. It's kind of missing out, though. You know, it's leaving aside what could be a very nice piece of the game, especially like I mentioned before, in terms of character progression. I think sometimes people who are new to Mithras, D100 gaming, if you come from a level-based background, you may not get that nice dopamine hit of leveling up every now and then. But this is how you can plan in a sensible and unique way about how your character is going to go through their lives and grow and change. So it's something that you might want to have a little structure in the beginning, like maybe one of your character's goals is to become a member in this organization. And maybe in the first couple adventures, their success or not will determine whether they get into the organization, right? Then now they're in the inner circle a little bit and they begin to learn what's going on. So if you're going to start off along those lines, you really do have to have some basics in mind about what the organization is going to require and what it's going to offer. You know, why does any character, this character in particular, want to join this group? And that's tied to backstory. And so everything can be integrated seamlessly this way. It's a really nice way to tie mechanics to role playing, which I like very much.
Yeah, I have to agree. And I mean, you certainly could do it both. I mean, like many people who are coming from like a D20 game are used to seeing a full spread of how that character is going to advance through their class, right? And they may see some higher level power and say, oh, I really am interested in that, and it really kind of evokes the image of my character, and so they're going to want a fully done up cult, right? Fortunately, it's only five ranks worth of 20. So it's a little bit easier to kind of construct that. But some folks are like, oh, I'm not exactly sure what I want to do with my character, but I know that I would like these relatively low level abilities right now. And so then you can say, okay, well, we're going to start you out with a cult here. And I've only actually done up the first rank or two. And, you know, and then kind of once they get to the point, say, okay, where do you think you're going to look and go? And we'll start kind of constructing it as we go. That totally works. I don't know if I'd recommend it for everybody, but it does work just fine. I don't know that I find them easy enough to construct on their own that I can pretty much get an idea within five ranks, right? Like, that's not too hard. Like, give me an idea of what your character does and a kind of talk down. It's like, okay, what do you see him being in 20 years? What do you see his big powers? And you can kind of make some notes and kind of fill it in as you go. I've had a few cults where I did it up and I said to the guy, this doesn't feel quite right, and I'll add something in or I'll put in a restriction. And they're usually in agreement with that.
And that's sort of like opening it up to co-creation. So the players are having that input as well, which I feel then leads to a better campaign in the long run like that. One of the things that we spent a lot of time looking at were the culture of our characters and where they actually originate from. So does culture bring, is that important when we creating the cults?
I think it makes for a better cult for sure. So like if you have some cultural context about why the cult came into being, it can make it much more interesting. So like if you have some, you know, some warrior culture, like a, you know, Klingon culture or perhaps even a samurai, you know, like the samurais, then you can look at that and say, oh, now I have a reason for this to exist. And that context helps put in things like oaths and other restrictions to kind of shape it and define it much more than just a bag of powers, right? Like that's, it kind of gives it some substance there, right? And really gets it that extra oomph that it needs to make it look really cool.
Yeah, very much so. The culture bits, you know, again, this is a way that Mithras ties the role-playing to the mechanics very nicely. A culture is not just, you know, the set of [S2] Yep. [S1] Standard and professional skills that you get during character generation. It also, you know, it tells you a little bit about why your character is the way they are. You know, likes, dislikes, beliefs, superstitions, you know, and basically everything, you know, and how much you want to define about that in the beginning is really dependent on the GM and the players. I like to leave hooks hanging there, but I like to keep things brief, like, you know, a couple paragraphs, one paragraph, two paragraphs. And we touched a lot on this kind of stuff in a previous episode.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that. I mean, this is very analogous to when we were talking about building a campaign where you don't want to define the world out of the gate, because if you do define the world out of the gate, you've locked yourself into that and you have to make all the pieces fit all at once and you never actually get there. It's kind of the same with cults and tying into the culture, right? Like if you define the whole culture right out of the gate and define the whole cult out of the gate, you leave little room for another one that might come up, and you don't leave any room for proper interaction between them. You kind of stifle your own creativity.
Because how wide, what are the sort of like the spheres of influence for these cults? You know, are they sort of like continent wide, or are they like smaller areas of the map, or is that purely up to GMs to make that decision?
If you look at the not pejorative definition of cult, it usually implies a locality. In other words, not something that's so widespread. A cult could be, you know, just in a village, you know, among a couple hundred people. If you have one sorcerer and one apprentice, it may not make sense necessarily to use a cult structure for that.
Yeah.
But if you have a master with, you know, a half a dozen students, maybe then that's where you're starting to get
that bigger sphere, right?
Someone's going to get promoted first, right?
Right, right. And if you were to say turn this around and at the other end of the spectrum, make a cult out of a multinational corporation.
Right.
Where each rank, you know, you might have middle management there and you might have the C-suite folks and all of that. That's got a very different scope. A really great example actually is in the Tusken Empires book, where there's the cult to the emperor, which is nationwide. But there are divisions of that cult inside of it that represent different branches of it. And then there's another one that is like to the sun god or the sun king. I forget exactly what it is, but there's two different cults to the same divinity, and they have different structures and different powers. And I'm like, oh well, then, you know, those scopes are entirely different on them. So you really kind of define it as you're stepping into the cult and say, all right, how big a scope is this going to be? And this ties back to the other one, where if you define the whole thing out of the gate, well, then you've probably defined the scope of the cult when you get there. And that can hamper you. It can be useful too, but it can hamper you too.
Right. It depends a lot on who you are and what you have in mind, how you want to run your game. And for that matter, your group, your player group. Some groups are very passive and they want you to tell them what your world is like. And some groups are very interested in poking and prodding and changing the world that they find their characters in. And so, you know your group.
One of the things that comes up in the core rule book is this idea of membership. And is it okay to have a player character start off as a member of a cult, i.e. they've already made that decision, or is it better to wait until the campaign starts to develop itself and then lure the players into a cult that way?
I honestly have no problem starting them with it. I established the minimum specs for joining the cult. Often enough, it's, you know, 50% in some five skills. But even if they don't meet that, they can become the associate level, the lay member level of that, and say, like, this is the carrot for you to get there. If they have an idea, it's like, I want to be a sorcerer, then that's going to very much define them. Okay, what kind of sorcerer do you want to be? Oh, I want to be a necromancer. Okay, then perhaps we have your master, and this is the path that you're going to get there, and these are the steps along the way. They may love that, right? Like, that made me really get them into it. I've put a few cults out in game. My group doesn't bite as them as much. So I think it's probably a little group specific there.
And of course, like real life, which is one of the nice things about this, you know, your interest in this and that waxes or wanes as you go through life. You know, you may find yourself on a multi-adventure campaign arc where you're far from home and you're not surrounded by the people that you usually are, and you don't worship or you don't participate in their activities. And then your character comes back to hometown, right? And finds out that all this stuff has changed. And maybe they decide they don't want to be part of that group. Maybe they want to join a different group. And as long as your character has, you know, enough hours in the day to devote to it, you could be a member of more than one group, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is really a great thing about Mithras cults compared to many of the archetypes that show up in other ones, is that they are, you could be a member of two or three or five or eight, you know, depending on however it shows up, right? Like, however compatible they are. I mean, some of them are, you pay for membership, and well, as long as you got money, you're good to go, but they don't care, right? They don't have a lot of restrictions and structures that prevent you from doing that. You're obviously going to have problems if you're in a theist cult that doesn't allow you to wear armor, and then you're in a soldier's cult that gives you armor or may requires you to wear armor. It's like, that's not going to work. Right. But it's not siloed in that sense. For the D20 people, you can multi-class as much as you like, right? Like, that's as simple as that. And you're also not restricted to 20 levels. So you can be, you know, the grand master level in all of your cults, assuming that your campaign runs long enough, right? Like, and you obviously have enough hours in the day.
But don't worry, your character is going to be dead long before that.
we assume
well,
so.
One of the things I've thought is, especially with magic based cults, these cults that have a progression in the spells, and so you're working your way through the cult. If you left that cult, would is it the idea that those spells would be cut off as well? But or is it more the case that, well, you've been taught those, so as long as there's no deity providing the power, you can actually continue to cast those? What's your thoughts about leaving cults?
So I think in theism is the obvious choice of you cut off the magic, right? Like, that's the god is providing the magic, right? Like, your devotion, that if you leave the cult, you're clearly not devoted to them in the same sense that you were anymore. But sorcery, well, you're learning it out of a book, perhaps. Although it might be a restriction that you throw into it. So for like mysticism, I pretty regularly put in an oath into mysticism, or a geas into mysticism, that if you don't do something that is cult-like, then you will lose your access to your abilities. Nice. It kind of depends on how you want to do it, right? Like, it's not structured in that sense necessarily. Both are options. In animism, I don't know what I would do in animism.
If
like, how would you leave the animist cult?
Maybe all of your friendly spirits stop talking to you. It's just like if you get cut out of your friend group in real life, right?
That's right. That's right. That's right.
You're dead to them.
You're not in the clique anymore.
Right, exactly.
You have to sit at the table in the corner with the nerdy kids, right? So it's right.
You're not sitting at this lunch table anymore.
That's right.
That's a perfect analogy. I love that. And of course, maybe other spirits will, you know, lure you away from those friendly spirits to other spirits. You mentioned,
I talked about this in one of my first adventures, actually. Spoiler alert, in Secrets of Blood Rock, that's part of the backstory as to what happened to the shaman leader of this isolated group of mountain people. He got seduced by this other spirit and started hanging out with unclean spirits. And his his ancestor cult spirits like stopped talking to him, wouldn't go near him anymore.
I just thought of a great example in media that people can go and watch. If you go and watch Deep Space Nine, Kai Winn is seduced from the prophets to the Paw Wraiths over the course of many episodes. And if you think it's a spoiler at this point, well, it's been
a long time. At this point.
So I'm sorry. Yeah. So gotta let it go at some point. But she gets seduced over to that because the Paw Wraiths demonstrate power to her, and the prophets, they relied on faith, right? Like that was a thing. And so she got cast out from the prophets and went to the Paw Wraiths, but then she realized the error of her ways and there was some drama around that too.
So let's take an even more super obvious example. The Star Wars arc.
Oh yeah, that's a good one too.
Anakin Skywalker from Jedi to Sith and redemption. Ultimately.
Yeah, yeah. Those are both cults, right? Like you've got the light side and the dark side cults. And people can go and Google that RuneQuest 6 supplement on that. So
that doesn't exist. That one, yes.
That totally doesn't exist, that you can't Google and find online anywhere.
No.
Okay, let's talk about restrictions and oaths. How important are they and how restricting should they be?
I'm going to give Matt a chance to say, because he had that. I'm going to think about this for a moment. Look. So because I have strong opinions. So I think they're super important. I think it's important to have some. I don't think that they necessarily need to be super strong, but I do think it's important to have some restrictions in the cult to give it shape. I think it's as important to have that as it is to have the powers. If you were to think about any of the classic stuff that we have out there in the D20 world, like your wizards, they can't wear armor. That is a geas, right? Like that is straight up a geas in Mithras. You could easily do that stuff. Or the priests have to have their holy symbol to be able to cast spells, or they have to remain faithful, or paladins have to remain lawful good. Those are all restrictions that define that character much more than their powers do, right? I think they're incredibly important and add so much. And they don't have to be incredibly strong. They don't have to be, you know, never picks up edged weapons or something like that, right? But they should be there. They should be there.
Matt?
I agree. The reason that I like them restrictions is because it helps to add drama to a game. It makes for hard choices sometimes, right?
That's a good point, right? Like this is the sort of like, you know, Superman doesn't have a lot of drama around him necessarily because he can solve everything by being super strong or whatever, right? But it's much harder when you have those restrictions.
Right. It can create moral dilemmas. Suppose you have a really good healer in the party, but their restriction is, you know, this cult is the sworn enemy of that cult, and your party, your group of friends and people who are going to keep you alive on the adventure are, you know, they need information from this enemy cultist who's dying.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Right. Like he's like, no, I'm not going to heal them. They're a sworn enemy, but we need him, and like, let him die. He's not worth it. Right. It would be a great moment of drama. There's that Irish folk hero, the guy with the spear that I can never pronounce his name. I believe he, I mean, yeah, yeah, yeah. He had a geas on him as well. I think that's actually the origin of the word, if I remember right. But those sorts of things are so important, that you tell so much more story about those than the actual powers that should come out of it. Matt's dead on that. It absolutely brings a lot of drama to it.
And I can see that. And I think it really adds depth to the not only the campaign, but the role playing and the encounters that actually can occur, you know, or might occur. One of the other things in the cult is this idea of gifts. And when I first came to Mithras, one of the gifts that I read was, if killed, then the character rises from the dead 1d6 days after death, their body completely healed of any and all damage to it. So, which is wonderful. I really like that. But what are these ideas of these gifts and how powerful are they? Who wants to start?
A lot of them are really powerful. The gift Lucky.
Yeah.
Oh, Lucky is insane.
It gives you an infinite supply of luck points, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's Lucky is insane. Like, I don't know whether that's going to ever show up in my game. It's really powerful.
It's
really, really powerful.
It is. And I think it's almost like the destined power of Lucky. Because I know that Mr. Pickles plays Rabbit that has Lucky, and he just seems to have an unlimited luck pool.
Yeah, it's worse than the destined power of Lucky. Lucky only like doubles your luck points, right? This is like, oh no, I roll, and I can swap it around anytime. I'm like, what?
Yeah. Anytime you make a roll, you get to swap the digits if you feel.
Yeah. Like. And on the other end of the spectrum, we have things like animal familiar, or you can swap your gender, which are not necessarily all that powerful at all. They are just a special thing that you can do. There's you get a sanctuary where you have a place that you're safe from your cult's enemies. Well, is that good for your game? Maybe. I don't know.
If you're playing Buffy the Vampire Slayer, that's a really good gift.
That's a great thing for your game. But if you're a traveling adventurer, I don't care. I'm never there, right? Like it really depends on your game. So they can kind of range from all over the place, but they should be they're kind of an exclusive thing that nobody else in the world gets except in the cult, right? Like that's the source. Mm-hmm. That's a source of a thing. I was thinking like a good example from like classic fantasy, like the fighters get proficiency in every weapon, like their weapon style includes everything. That's functionally a gift. Yes, you can do combat styles like that, but compared to a core Mithras thing, that would absolutely be a gift. My combat style encompasses all weapons, and if you add new ones, I'm proficient in it. And I'm like, oh wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah. And there are other functional ones too in there, like there's one that lets you add your POW to your com plus size when you figure your hit points, things like that. Like if you were a mighty warrior favored by the gods, that would totally be a really straightforward, useful thing to have, right? Not exactly off the chain, but definitely a step up from regular folks. You're definitely blessed if you get a gift like that, or a holy weapon, for example.
Yep. Absolutely.
So are these gifts able to be gained by any level of the cult?
Not usually.
Or is it just reserved for the high flyers?
I mean, it really depends on the gifts. I put them in all over the place. I don't usually put them in any lower than third rank, whatever. Mm-hmm. Like there's apprentice, disciple. Yeah, like the third level, the adept rank. Like I usually don't put them in below that. Occasionally, I'll put a weak one in there occasionally. Like I think my one of my recent ones, the Aegis Arcanum, I think they have. You can get food and shelter from just about anywhere because you're wearing the roads, right? Like it's not powerful, but it's going to save you from dying, right? Like it's going to save you from starvation.
Because I tend to run low magic games, I tend to have gifts that are not magical, that are straight up practical. Like, you know, you get free skill training, you get free room and board, you get essentially sanctuary when you're in a strange city. Think about it. If you're a traveler and, you know, you end up in a strange place and maybe you think that people are after you or going to jump you or something. Can you imagine just having a safe house that you could walk into? And even though these people are strangers, you know that you can sleep that night without worrying about waking up dead, right?
I mean, skill training is a great one to put in at the low ranks, right? Like you could say, you know what, you're like an associate, but then you decide that you're going to go deeper in the cult and you take that first real rank. And at that point, it's like, look, we're going to train you in skills that we're not going to give you a discount, but we will train you in the cult skills. And that by itself is enough of a gift that it is incentive. Like I watched my players, like I offered training in the game and I watched a very radical change in behavior. Them suddenly they're like looking at their XP, it's like, oh, I can hoard it until I get back to my cult or back to town, or I can spend it now. And it was very serious. Like I couldn't believe it. They're like, oh, I love that training, give me some of that training, right? Like it was giving them a drug or something.
I would go one step further and say that I would give it to him for free in the sense of not costing any silver pennies.
Oh, but you got to do
turn it into an economy of favors.
Yeah.
You know, they have to do this or that for the bosses, you know, and then think about it. If you're in a mob or something like that, you start off as an errand boy and you have to do these things, but eventually you're going to be a made man, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I like that idea. I like the exchange of favors. One thing that I was looking at with the progression is that I think it's really cleverly designed to match certain skills, the skills of the cult up to a certain percentage. But one of the things that I found difficult was this idea of periods of time of service. You have to be a member of the cult for X amount of years. How do you deal with that in the campaign worlds? Or is it something that you just leave? How do you deal with that?
So I mean, as much as anything, that really is defined by the scope of your campaign, right? Like, so if you, those ones where you've got to be a member of the cult for 10 years, in most games, that's not going to be suitable for player characters, right? Like they're not going to want to join into that because they don't know how long the campaign's going to go on. And 10 years in game may mean something entirely different. That might be a great thing to put into a game where you anticipate that the campaign is going to end and then you're going to pick it up 10 years in the future in the game world, right? Like, and then you can just say they advanced, right? Like you don't want to play out 10 years. Nobody wants to do that. At least I don't think they do. I know there's a few of those cults, like in Fenlai has one, the Paladins have that sort of thing. Like you get to a point in the cult and then after that point, you're supposed to settle down and get married. Like that's part of the cult. But I don't want to do that.
That's good. That's really good. Put a crimp in my adventuring plan.
Right? Right. Like I don't want to do that.
Like, and, you like to travel, baby, right?
Yeah, right. Like, you're supposed to actually settle down there. You get a plot of land and you're supposed to stay around the area. It's very funny.
That's classic. I like that. I was thinking about what if you wanted to create an older character who was, you know, solid level 3 in a cult, ready to take the step forward to level 4 because they had already put in 20 or 30 years, right? And so their drives are very much oriented towards doing that last thing, that extra oomph, that extra piece of flair that they need to get promoted, right? So that would go a long way toward defining that kind of character, and maybe shaping party politics too while you're at it. On the other hand, you could have a younger character who, you know, was just a training hound and did really well, got lucky with their roles, you know, allotted their skill points properly in character generation. And so maybe they're like shooting up through the ranks in just one or two game years, right? But then, of course, within an organization of people who have put in 20 years, they're looking at this new person and there's going to be politics and you know, resentment and all those sorts of things, even in, you know, a smiley, happy, good religious cult, right? There are going to be all these human interactions that go along with it. So they might find themselves bumping up against a different set of challenges suddenly.
Yeah, a whole new set of drama that comes out of that.
I have found that if you're bringing in a new character into an existing campaign, then that's a really good way to, if they're a member of a cult, up in their level so they can come in at roughly the same sort of like skill level and ability level. And like you were saying, I think it really adds to the role-playing aspect of it, especially if there's going to be some conflict there as well. Is there anything that you think is really important about cults and brotherhoods that we haven't spoken about, or any tips that you have?
So let's see. So, I mean, we already talked about restrictions, which I think are super important. I think that, and I think it bears repeating, honestly, that's how important I think they are. I think that you don't have to have a world-spanning cult to make it a good cult. There are plenty of examples in other games if you want to go and pull from them. I think Classic Fantasy honestly has some of the best examples of cults that there are out there. And they really form a nice bridge for people that are coming from D20 games. Because if you just think of the class as a cult and you can see what it is there, and quite literally, if you remove the multi-class experience penalty from Classic Fantasy, they're straight cults. Like, they're straight cults. The other good place to go and look at them, in the Mithras products is Monster Island. There's a full suite of animism cults, and a full suite of sorcery cults, and a full suite of theism cults that you can go pull on. It's important, though, that those are setting based, right? Like, these, so much of the stuff that we're talking about is really tied deeply, deeply, deeply into whatever setting it is. So you, as a GM, when you're going through and looking at this, is like, okay, I need to have a good idea of what my setting really looks like. It's a world building activity in some sense of it. If you don't have a good idea of the setting, your cults are going to look weird in the setting.
When I first was looking at Mithras, learning the game system, the Cults and Brotherhoods structure that's laid out in the core book struck me as a really good piece of game writing and a really useful framework, because it works in so many different ways. It's elegant, right? The only trick that I would say is, because Mithras is a toolkit, I suppose, and the authors, I suppose, were looking to make something that would be universally useful, the upper levels of a cult, as written in the book, you know, they required you to have skills at 110%, more than one. It seems to me that if you force that five-tier structure onto every single organization you try to make, it's not always going to work well. The example that I like to use is, you know, suppose you have a particular platoon of soldiers in an army, right? That's famous for being this or that, right? So there's going to be like the leader, right?
Yep.
Nick Fury and his Howling Commandos or something like that. Right? There's going to be the leader, but that leader guy doesn't necessarily, you know, have to be what would be called rank 5 in the core book. Maybe that person only has 90% in their best skills, right? And maybe the people who are one step down, you know, only have like 70 or 80% in their skills, and everybody else is at the entry level. my tip would be to not feel super constrained by the formula that is in the core book, and to be variable on that. You don't need to have 5 tiers. You know, if you're talking about replicating something like the Catholic Church that's been around for 2,000 years and has a huge internal hierarchy and everything, you know, then maybe you want to have people who are at the tippy top who really are paragons in what they're meant to represent. But not all organizations are going to have as many tiers, I think, as are in the hierarchy in the book. And so don't feel handcuffed by that. And don't worry about, you know, creating NPCs that are going to be ultra powerful in this sense.
Yeah.
So
I think a thing that we can touch on there with those organizations is that oftentimes what gets a person to the top of the cult is not actually the skills that they learn in the cult or learned by the cult, what's taught by the cult. You might have that set of 5 skills that, like, you are required to learn these skills or something like that to enter. And you might even progress through that hierarchy from, you know, like 50 to 70 to 90. And then at that point, your learning in those is unimportant as far as the cult's concerned. Maybe they say, and now you have to have this new skill at some rank, or you need to have an oath at some rank, or you need to show passion at some rank, or something like that, right? Like, it doesn't necessarily have to be that straight progression. And I've done a lot of cults with just that straight progression. By no means does it need to do that. Thenla has a whole raft of examples that are not like that at all. They're kind of all over the place. So you can help define that structure of the cult by doing a change in the middle of that. It's like, maybe your guys are never interested in learning what the leading the cult. And so they're like, oh, well, we're only going to define the first 3 ranks for adventurers. And then after that, it's all political stuff and you don't care. And they're like, okay.
That sounds absolutely brilliant. I think you're going to, Doug, I think you're going to be putting out some cults with design notes. Is that right?
So I've been putting them out one or two a week on d100-workshop.blogspot.com. And you can, I've been posting them on Reddit. I've been posting, they go in the Discord automatically. Most of these are really there to just kind of help people get their mind around building cults and to see what range you can go to. They range from the relatively straightforward and simple sorcery cult to, like, I put up the Seekers of the Great Void here a week or two back that uses chaos features as the gifts. And that as an option for the gifts, and they're like, what, you can just do that? I'm like, oh yeah, today, I mean, this morning I put up a pyromancer cult, and it's a gift at the high level power is that you start burning on fire, burns off all your clothes, straight out of the Bright Wizard from Warhammer. Like, nobody wants to be around you because you are literally too hot to handle. It doesn't hurt you, but it doesn't help your equipment any, so
yikes.
Yeah, brilliant. I will put that link in the show notes for the podcast as well. But like you say, it automatically, I think I've seen it, it automatically publishes to the Discord as well.
Now, I do have to say, I have another cult on there that came out of when I played in one of Matt's modules. I don't think you were actually playing the game, if I remember right. We were playing with Humble Dragon. We were playing, one of the Savage Swords things. And I made an animist who used djinn and did a quite a full cult on that. Nice. Is all around poetry and language and being able to con the djinn into doing stuff for you. It's a very neat cult, and I'm honestly pretty proud of it. But it came out of his stuff. It definitely has that flavor.
Nice. You're inspiring people, Matt.
Oh, dear.
This is
you guys got to get better friends or something.
It's been absolutely fantastic talking to you both yet again. You really develop my understanding about animism and all that, which I am pleased to say that we have our first animist joining the campaign.
Yay!
Which I,
animism!
I am super excited about it, and I've been able to put all your points into operation. And I did start off with, okay, then what spirits are going to be friendly? You know, we started right from that point. And it's worked. Honestly, it's worked like a dream. It really, really has. And all that discussion. So I will be talking to my players about their existing cults and brotherhoods and how we can develop them more, especially with restrictions, oaths, and probably gifts in the future. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been absolutely fantastic once again.
Thanks, Emeralds.
Thank you very much.
And that's it. Another episode of Mithras Matters completed. Don't forget, you can check out all my content by following my YouTube channel and the campaign areas on World Anvil. I really appreciate your support, and do check out the Discord and the Tapper Talk forums. There are great people there sharing their ideas within the discussions. So, until next time, have a great month of gaming, and I will chat to you all again in August. How fast does the year fly? Until then, I hope that all your imposed roles succeed and provide you with a well-deserved special. Thanks for listening, everyone. See ya. Bye. The content of this podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 license, so please give appropriate credit if you are sharing or copying any part of this podcast. Thank you.